us. And Jay, please eat your veggies. You need them.
Eat the veggies. Harvested in a sustainable food forest. All right. Until next time.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.
You're listening to 90.7 BOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Tell your friends to listen on in and support the mass movement of the human tribe. Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Hand him on my whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver scream. Can't tell them apart.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest week is Helen Swift. She's the Japan Foundation Assistant Curator of Japanese Art at the Portland Art Museum, and she's here talking about Human Nature, which is on now at the Portland Art Museum through May the 7th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus by Zoom, Helen.
Thank you, Sancho. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, welcome to the program. You've been with the museum for 6 months, and you have gone through the Gilkey collection, the print collection, picking out these Japanese prints. They're colored prints from about the last 150 years, I think.
That's right. So the focus of the exhibition and a huge part of the Portland Art Museum collection is Japanese woodblock prints. So in the museum, there are nearly 3,000 Japanese prints of various kinds, but a huge part is woodblock, which became a major medium for print design and making in the Edo period, so from the 17th to 19th centuries. And this exhibition really focuses on the 19th century and carries forward into the 20th to see the legacy of that tradition in the modern age. And so many of the prints do come from the Gilkey collection and also from other local collectors. There seems to be a great love for woodblock prints, Japanese art, images of landscape here throughout over time, Portland. So a lot of prints are from the Mary Andrews Ladd's collection, which was donated in 1932, and was one of the biggest donations the museum had received at that time, of around about 800 Japanese prints. Mm. So a lot of the prints are also from that collection.
Well, I was amazed at the detail. I always think of woodblock as being very kind of, you know, crude in its detail, and compared to like intaglio or, you know, that very fine etching style. And then the colors are amazing. You know, some of them are really bright colors. So just tell us a little bit about this kind of type of woodblock printing.
I think that's one of the reasons we're also drawn to these prints, is because of that craft that goes into it. Technique is, as you say, they could really get some very fine lines. And so it was a collaborative process. So the name that is on the label today in the museum, like Kaga Hokusai or Utagawa Hiroshige, is really just the person who designed the image. And they would do that with brush and ink on paper. They would then pass that image to somebody who specialized in carving the woodblock itself. And then a separate person would print the images using mostly organic pigments. And so everybody is very expert in what they do, from design to cutting. And that's how you get this really exquisite craft. And the colors are really something that was enabled by the invention of a process of multiple woodblocks being used. So every color that you see on a print now would have a separate woodblock cut for that one color. So you could have a dozen or more separate blocks that constitute one image. And the colors, as I said, was the organic. But what's interesting with the landscape prints is that around that time, at the beginning of the 19th century, a new blue pigment is being introduced into Japan, known today as Berlin or Prussian blue. And that really allowed artists to use a very rich and wider range of blues in their prints. Before that, the organic pigments, they were very fugitive. So they would fade in light very quickly, and you couldn't really portray the sky or water in the way that you could once Berlin blue came in.
I mean, everything is slightly yellowish tinged. Is that fading?
Yes, probably. And the paper itself can sometimes
change. Oh, okay.
happens. So as that's underlying the whole design, I guess the yeah could come from there as well.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, everyone knows one Japanese artist is Hokusai, famous mm-hmm. for the Great Wave. You know, it's a poster in every movie. It tries to represent Japan. You have a series of prints by Hokusai, waterfalls. You know, some of the, well, there are different views, but there are a little section on waterfalls. And some of them are just quite surreal. You have one called the Falling Mist Waterfall at Mount Kurakami in Shimotsuke. And it's a tour of waterfalls in various provinces. And it looks like a kind of giant spore. I mean, the falling water is kind of stylized. It's broad bands of white. It's kind of like a long exposure photo, you know, where they try and capture water. But it's mostly blue and white. And there is some red rock or kind of brown. And then these little figures in the foreground, which are maybe, you know, at 10% of the height of the print itself. It's quite amazing. Do you know anything about Hokusai, how he would sit at a waterfall? What was his method?
So Hokusai has left us with a really dramatic image of the natural world today. And I think that the waterfall series we have on display really is very representative of his approach to nature. So he's often described as being naturalistic. He pays a great deal of attention to natural phenomena and plants and animals and really studied them very closely. But I think he goes beyond naturalism in many of his prints, and particularly in the waterfall series. So he sort of helps us see there's this approach to nature throughout Japanese history that's that regards it as almost divine, and that places like waterfalls or mountaintops were often regarded as homes to what are called kami, so these kind of spirits or gods of nature. Mm-hmm. And so the way he portrays it, each waterfall, like the one you just described, is very unique and vibrant and feels really alive. And then you see these figures at the bottom staring up towards the waterfall, just absolutely in awe of what they're seeing. And so you really get that sense of reverence for nature through both the way Hokusai portrays the waterfall, but then also the figures in the image that you can kind of identify with and step into perhaps what they're feeling. And that would be a very strange feeling for someone in the Pacific Northwest in our region, where we actually can go out and see these waterfalls around us and feel that awe.
Is there any sense of ironic detachment with Hokusai? Is he very traditional? Is he just focusing on a spiritual aspect of nature? Or is this some kind of self-referential treatment of the history of, you know, artistic interpretation of nature?
I think that's a really great question, actually, because I think he does all of those things. So he not only does reflect that reverence I just described, but also what he's showing is the development of the tourist culture in Japan at that time. People are traveling because they can and it's fun. And many of the figures in his images are almost foolish or silly. And they show all the different things you might observe among travelers on the road back then and today. So it's not always so serious. And then with regard to that kind of self-referential aspect, I think perhaps more in his images of Mount Fuji, there's a very personal connection for him. He really desired to live as long as he could to become a better artist. And for him and many others, Fuji was a symbol of immortality. And so there's a lot of reference in our historical material on Hokusai about his relationship to Fuji and his desire to have immortality and to become the best artist he could.
Mm-hmm. So he was nearly 90 when he died?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. He was very long-lived, so I guess it paid off. But I think he really loved he loved being an artist, and it really kept going. He never retired.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's a camping store in Portland called Snow Peak. It's a Japanese camping store. Mm-hmm. And I went for a little tour, and they said, in Japan, camping's different. You kind of set your tent up and your table and everything in relation to the landscape. And then in this exhibition, you talk about famous sites or famous places. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yes, so there's a tradition of famous places, the Japanese word isho, and that's this tradition of there being locales and places around the country that are written about in poetry, or some event happened there that made them famous. They're usually natural sites, like rivers with cherry blossoms, or places, mountains famous for autumn leaves, things like that. And so they were written about by poets as far back as the 9th century in Japan. And then that sort of becomes canonized over time. And so by the time you get to the 19th century, there are these natural landscapes that are just so rich with cultural, historical memory that people would want to go and see them. And prints really helped kind of promote that within a tourism kind of culture. So people would go to sites that had been famous since the 9th century, partly because they perhaps saw a print by Hiroshige or Hokusai that then gave them this image of what that would like. And they go to that site with those things in their mind, the images, the poetry, and go to appreciate it. It's a tradition that then gets more, not modernized, but it gets updated so that it can play with the print market, the tourist culture. And then Hiroshige creates new famous places in and around the capital city of the time, Edo, which is now Tokyo. So it wasn't historically famous places as part of Japan. They were mostly around Kyoto. But Hiroshige did a great job of really pictorializing the famous places of the city.
Yeah, so his name was Utagawa Hiroshige.
Yeah.
And you have one of his pieces. It's called Shono Driving Rain. And it's from this 53 stations of the Tokaido, you know, 1830s. And it's people walking sort of from right to left. I think they're on a ridge or going up a hill, and it's just very, very windy. All the foliage in the background is all pointing to the top left corner of the rectangle, and they're all leaning over, the hair is blowing. It's just a very dramatic picture, but it's so simple in a way. It's quite amazing. Tell us a little bit about Hiroshige.
So Hiroshige is a slightly younger artist than Hokusai, who we just talked about, his waterfalls. And he's really famous for his very atmospheric, lyrical landscape scenes. And so he's really good at capturing things like rain, which you just described. And the series that that image is from, the 53 stations of the Tokaido, was the one that really made him, made a career. It was incredibly successful. So each of the 53 stations, they were waypoints along the Tokaido, which is Japan's major highway during this time. And in fact, today it's the bullet train runs up and down the country from Tokyo to Kyoto. So it's still kind of a legacy. So Hiroshige is really good at showing people facing the adversities of the road and the weather. There's lots of massive rivers, and various climatic conditions made it a hard slog. But there's also these little narrative figures, either fighting against rain, like you just described, or sitting on the side of the road enjoying a snack. After all, there's something appealing about travel too. These prints, they were picked up by people on the road who were attracted to them as souvenirs, but they also sold in the city for people who perhaps couldn't travel. And it would be like armchair traveling for them. So looking at National Geographic or something like that today.
Yeah. And the Wall Street Journal in their piece about the show mentions, you know, prints for the price of a bowl of noodles. So these really were kind of postcard level of an investment. Is that correct?
Yes. Obviously, there was variation in price depending on size and colors and how famous the artist was, that kind of thing. But yeah, it's the commonly quoted benchmark for price of rent is around the same as a bowl of noodles. So it really was something that anybody could buy. And certainly they did. And for that reason, actually, lots of prints haven't survived to today, because they were just pasted up on the wall, or, you know, they weren't treated as fine art objects like they are today. So something like Hiroshige's 53 stations was probably printed in editions of thousands in its time. And now we're fighting over a few hundred for our museum collections.
My name is Joseph Gall. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Helen Swift. She's the Japan Foundation Assistant Curator of Japanese Art at the Portland Art Museum. And she's talking about Human Nature, a show of woodblock prints, which is on now through May the 7th at the museum. There are other pieces in this show that are very modern. I mean, there's a Maki Haku. It's a piece from 1989. It's a really stunning blue. It's Mount Fuji, snowy top. All the non-snowy areas is dark blue. There's no detail. And then the sky is this beautiful kind of sunsetty blue. It's kind of a dusky blue, light where the mountain is, and then getting darker in a very gentle gradation to the top. It's a really stunning piece. It's a color woodblock print with embossing. Who is Maki Haku?
So he's a 20th century artist who actually better known for prints, kind of still life style prints of tea bowls and fruits and things like that. He really does these exquisitely detailed naturalistic renderings in the print medium. And so it's interesting, his approach to Mount Fuji is quite different to his usual style. I think the textures that he normally has in work are kind of missing from this print. As you described, you've got quite a simple palette of really deep, flat colors. to me kind of speaks to the iconic status of Mount Fuji in Japan even now. And whereas he sort of usually depicts things that you can hold in your hand or collect or that have a strong material presence, it feels like with Fuji, he's very aware of the immateriality of it in many ways, always seeing it on the horizon and its sort of status as immortal and transient.
It's a square composition. It does look kind of like a Polaroid or an Instagram picture, but he's cropped it so that there's more of the left side of the mountain than the right. There's less slope on the going down the right side. And, you know, it looks like Mount Hood to me. It's like a slightly snub-nosed Mount Hood. And the first day I landed in Portland 29 years ago, the first thing I saw, you know, in July was that snowy mountain with the shows and ridges where there was no snow. So he's taking an icon, and so many people use Fuji in this show. What do you think he's doing to this icon?
I think he's sort of celebrating it for the modern age, showing its continued relevance. I mean, it's so much bigger. It was always a big presence in Japanese culture. The minute Japan entered into the international, sort of the world stage in the late 19th century, then it becomes even greater presence and an icon of Japan internationally. And I think it's the sort of legacy that his print is speaking to. And it's thought that that design was made for a collaborative exhibition of prints of Mount Fuji. So a host of artists from that time were looking at Fuji. And for him, it's probably the first time he was really looking at Fuji as an artist. He hadn't really approached it before. But it's very interesting to see how he's about that.
So it's kind of become like a logo for the country globally, but also for him. He was scaling up from teacups and bowls up to some trees and kind of treating it a bit like a logo too, right?
He was probably very aware of all of the images of Fuji that come before him, of course, particularly someone like Hokusai. So maybe that he chose to use blue in the way that he did because of Hokusai and Hiroshige using blue in their 19th century prints. And even the way you describe this on the left side of the mountain being longer than the right-hand side, that's also something you see fairly often in Hokusai's images of Mount Fuji. There's usually one slope longer than the other.
Seikino Junichiro, I hope I'm saying that right, has some fabulous stuff. One of them, it's just on the left as you go in. If you go and turn left, it's this beautiful, brightly colored collection of streamers. They're kind of like kites, but they're on bendy sticks, like fishing poles. They look like squids, you know, but they're red and white and green and yellow. And Fuji's kind of looming in the background. And then right on the bottom, there's a whole row of little faces in black, people in black clothes. It's amazing. I mean, the sort of movement and drama of the picture, and yet you have these tiny little people at the bottom and then this looming mountain in gray on a blue sky background. It's another 53 Stations piece, but it's a different artist, right?
Yes, that's right. So Seikino Junichiro was a major artist in the 20th century who designed and carved and printed his own woodblock prints. He was really inspired by the Hiroshige series that we were just discussing. So he actually went along the same route along the Tokaido Highway. I'm, of course, by train and car, not walking on foot. But he went to all those same places and did images of them as they appear today, but with also an element of nostalgia woven into them as well.
So he died in 1988. When do you think these were made, like in the 60s?
So he'd been traveling around America and Europe in the 1950s, and then he came back to Japan in the 60s and started this series of his homeland, I guess. And it took him about 15 years to do the whole series. So he did a few stations at a time and would actually go into them in person before creating his prints.
One of the images is actually of Mount Rainier in winter. It's called Mount Rainier in Winter, 1972. Yuda Toshi, when you were sorting through the prints, and what was your attitude towards the overlap between America and Japan in this imagery and artistry?
Usually when I think about the relationship between Japan and America in artistic terms, I think about woodblock prints and how they came over to America and Europe and influence artists. But in this case, I was more interested in perhaps the significance to people in both Portland and Tokyo or Edo, the significance of the landscape to people, to their identity, cultural memory. So I was really looking to find images that would speak to that. And also, of course, in a very superficial way or topographically, we share similar landscapes. So Mount Fuji, really, they resemble one another, Mount Fuji and Mount Hood. And it was also interesting in the case of the artist you just mentioned, Yoshida Toshi, A lot of Japanese artists have come to the Pacific Northwest. They often came to work at universities here, or Gordon Gilkey, who helped found the collections here, was an early curator. He had a good relationship with a lot of these artists himself, and so really encouraged them to come to the region. And they would create these, couldn't help themselves, I guess, to create these beautiful prints of the landscape here.
Yeah. You know, we're, I always think of like, oh, Japan woodblock prints blast onto the scene in France in, you know, the late 1800s. And, you know, Van Gogh sees them and he's inspired, changes the way modern art evolved. But how do you think they came across to America? Obviously, it came later, right, in the sense of their impact.
Yeah, so I think some of the impact similar in terms of pictorial method and different ways of framing images or colors or compositions that really inspired artists here as they did in Europe. There's also this idea maybe that prints, woodblock prints themselves were initially spurned by some American experts in Japan. So there was an expert in Botan, Ernest Fenollosa, initially thought that they weren't worthy of representing Japan overseas because they weren't really fine art. But that soon changed. Prints are very popular with collectors. You can see why when you see the prints in the show, they're just so gorgeous. But also, they're quite attainable in monetary terms. So obviously the prices did go up. You couldn't get a bowl of noodles anymore. But nonetheless, they were something that were quite easy to collect for a time in early 20th century. And a lot of people really fell in love with collecting these prints. And so there's sort of a democratic idea about what these prints are as well. And it has been argued in America that was part of their appeal, that they were accessible, they presented the lives of everyday people. They weren't fine art as such. And so that became appealing.
Yeah. I mean, I think of it as like, oh, you have this art form that is sort of cartoon-like. There's a lot of flatness to it and it's going along happily. And then when Europe discovers the simplicity of early modernism, then it kind of chimes Europe and they're like, wow, someone else has been doing this for hundreds of years, you know, and isn't it amazing? And we can do this. We're not constrained by naturalism anymore. That's kind of how I think of it. But you say there's also this kind of democratic notion that, you know, they were popular art and that appeals to America too.
Yes, it's that is a very, perhaps one of the big differences between the Europe and American appeal of Japanese prints. But I think in many cases, it's also a universal appeal in terms of the how eloquent they are. Just looking at, I mean, this is why I chose the landscape prints as well for an exhibition. They were the first thing that drew me into Japanese art history. And I think it's really hard to, it's hard to deny the power of these images, the colors, the landscapes, the weather, just, the compositions.
There's another Yoshida Hiroshi piece. It's a bunch of boats. You know, sort of in a harbor, and there's a kind of rolling landscape in a background, green, and then it higher mountains are brown. But there, these boats are all picked out in sort of pink and white, and then the masts, they've taken the time to capture the shimmer of the reflection, so the reflected masts are all squiggly, you know, and it's just such a nice detail that it really stuck out to me. You know, it wasn't as stylized as some of the other imagery in the show.
Yeah, it's interesting actually that you identified that print because Yoshida Hiroshi actually studied European styles of painting in oil and watercolor, and so you know, the relationship goes both ways between Japan and Europe and America artistically. So there's also Japanese artists who are looking to European traditions and finding ways to reinvigorate their art. And I think you can see that in the work of someone like Yoshida, where, as you say, it's less stylized. There's a bit more naturalism, study of light and perspective, for example. But there's also really profound nostalgia, I think, in those paintings, prints rather. So even though it's in the 1930s when Japan is industrialized, you don't see too much of that in the print that you just described.
And I would point out, if anybody sees pictures online or in paper, the color is not as good as in real life. They're much brighter and just really kind of jump out at you. Just talk a little bit about there's a series going kind of upriver to the pleasure zone around Edo. Tell us who are the main artists who are working on those that you've recruited here?
Well, it comes back to Hokusai and Hiroshige again. They really are the stars of this exhibition. And particularly for Hiroshige, who was turning his attention to the the capital city and the famous places in the city. The river itself is a famous place in its own right. There's history and stories surrounding it.
What's the name of the river?
The river's called Sumida, and it's still the main river running through Tokyo today. And for people in the 19th century, obviously it's a way of getting through the city. It's the main artery for transportation and commerce. But as you just described, it's also a site of fun. And so in the summer, when it's very hot in Tokyo, as I'm sure anyone who's ever been to East Asia or East Asia in the summer can imagine, it's nice to go down to the river and enjoy the cool when it gets dark. So we have images, for example, one by Utamaro, who was famous for his pictures of beauties. There's one image of these young men and women on boats by the river, just enjoying the cool and having a few drinks. And then we have other images by Hiroshige that show people moving up the river on boats. And that was the way that people would reach the red light district known as the Yoshiwara, which is really a major lull of woodblock print culture. I'm sure people have seen images of beautiful courtesans and things like that in woodblock print. So the river carried them up there and sort of transported them away, not just north up to where the district was located, but sort of in a more metaphysical or in a different way, metaphorical way, help them leave behind their worldly concerns and their jobs to be able to sail upriver and have some fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the one I was thinking of is called Pine of Success. So it focuses on this pine tree that was famous. And then there's a boat in the background, and a woman's silhouette on the little cabin of the boat, like on the window or the curtain, and then two pairs of sandals. So it says on the card, it's like there's a tryst going on. It's at night, so the stars are out, and the river is this beautiful pale blue, but it suddenly fades to dark indigo in the foreground. It's an amazing piece of art.
That's Hiroshige really capturing the atmosphere again. He's so good at that.
Yeah. And so the show's called Human Nature. It's like human and then this vertical line, nature. What does that mean?
So my idea for the show was that landscape is obviously, it's this crux of this relationship between people and the natural world. So we are influenced obviously by the landscape and inspired to create artwork. But also our culture really shapes the landscape and how it's seen. And a place really becomes a place when, you know, human memory and feeling decides to make it and paints it or draws it. So my interest was in trying to show this reciprocity between the natural world and people. And so we've talked about, there are some images that are very naturalistic, but there are also others that go beyond that, for example, with the waterfalls. And there's a lot of artifice as well in these images that is cleverly hidden, but really increases the aesthetic appeal of the natural world. So there's a lot of give and take on both sides.
It's an amazing show. I recommend you make a beeline there when you get in, and, you know, just go there first, because there's a lot to see. And it does gave me a whole new way of looking at, you know, printmaking from Japan, and particularly the use of color. It's just quite amazing.
Yes, and I'm really glad that it made you look at things differently, because a lot of them are well known. And so part of my desire was also to help people approach them in a new light. They might think that they know the Great Wave really well, for example, but I hope that this exhibition can help you see new details or different aspects of those works.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Helen Swift. She's the Japan Foundation Assistant Curator of Japanese Art at the Portland Art Museum. Helen was talking about Human Nature, a show of woodblock prints, which is on now through May the 7th. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Helen, and welcome to Portland.
Thank you. Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Andy Wawa looks a scream. Hang him on a wall. Andy Wawa, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at
Están escuchando KBOO Portland, su estación comunitaria.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 10 de enero del 2023. Rusia y Wagner probablemente controlan la mayor parte de Soledad en medio de feroces combates por la ciudad de Donbas, dijo el Ministerio de Defensa del Reino Unido en su última actualización. Rusia y Wagner han hecho avances tácticos en los últimos 4 días, dijo el ministerio, en lo que describió como muy probablemente un esfuerzo para envolver a Bakhmut desde el norte e interrumpir las líneas de comunicación. Pero el presidente de Ucrania, Zelensky, insistió que Bakhmut y Soledad aguantaban a pesar de la destrucción.